This is not a drill. Today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Hawaiians received a warning that a ballistic missile was headed their way. It turned out to be a false alarm, but it scared a lot of people, including this woman's mother.
She was almost in a state of denial while it was happening. But then afterward, it really hit her that this could really happen. And she's been shaking since.
And a Haitian-American artist describes the inspiration for his viral image of Martin Luther King Jr. silencing President Trump.
Wishing and hoping that he would think with a more equality type of mind rather than some of the negative stuff that he has been putting out into the universe.
Those stories, plus French actress Catherine Deneuve's complicated relationship with feminism, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for tuning in this Monday. It is, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. Day here in the U.S. The holiday marks the birthday of the civil rights leader who was murdered 50 years ago and his leading role in the fight for equal rights for all people. Black leaders and others have been reflecting on Dr. King's life and legacy over the long weekend. And in these times, it's not surprising that the conversation has turned in some cases to the rights of immigrants. Opal Tometi is the executive director of an organization called the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. She's also a co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Opal, you're a civil rights activist. Today marks 50 years since Dr. King celebrated his last birthday. On this MLK Day, how far do you think we've come as a country?
Sadly, I would have to say we haven't come as far as I think we need to have come, and that Dr. King, if he were alive today, would be standing alongside us, fighting for the rights of immigrants, fighting for the rights of Black people, of women, of the queer community, trans community, and many other disenfranchised communities across the United States and really across the globe. We still have a very far way to go.
I want to play a clip of Reverend Raphael Warnock speaking yesterday at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. That's a church where Dr. King delivered his first sermon in 1947.
So go out from this place and lift up the cause. Tell the politicians who will mouth pious pronouncements this weekend in honor of Dr. King that you have no right to celebrate the dream if you will not liberate the dreamers. Give these 800,000 young people who are in our schools and our colleges and our churches a dignified path to citizenship. The Bible says, woe to those who crush the poor. The Bible says, be good to the aliens who are among you. I see you're holding the Bible, but do you know what the Bible says?
Reverend Warnock there speaking about so-called dreamers, the nearly 800,000 people who've been protected from deportation under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program. The future of that program, of course, is now unclear. But Opal, how do you see Dr. King's message when it comes to issues of immigration?
I see it very much so as interlinked. So we know that Dr. King, if he were alive today, he would be saying much of the same things that he said in his time. So injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. I believe that these words resonate very much so with our communities today. Immigration is a racial justice issue. It is a Black issue. And I believe that he would be standing alongside us and declaring that he wants justice also for immigrants. Immigrants of all colors, actually. So not only am I talking here about African and Caribbean immigrants, but I'm talking about our siblings from across the Americas, across Asia, and beyond. And so we're standing up right now, all across the country. There are rallies that are taking place in cities like New York, in LA, and so on, calling attention to the fact that we have the opportunity to do right by the many hundreds of thousands of people and even millions of people who are in this country, who've made their way in this country, who have families and ties and who are in school and working and contributing to the society in so many various ways and who are intimately a part of the fabric of the United States.
I think in this country, there's sort of parallel discussions when it comes to race and immigration. Do you see immigration as a race issue?
I absolutely see immigration as a racial justice issue. Black Lives for Just Immigration was founded almost 12 years ago because we do see it as that. We see both African Americans as well as Black immigrants are being impacted by the immigration enforcement system, as well as the very egregious and growing anti-immigrant sentiment. We know that Black immigrants in particular are deported in record numbers. And so we're seeing Black immigrants, particularly from Africa, countries around the Caribbean, being locked up and deported at 5 times the rate of their actual presence in the United States. And so it speaks to the racial inequities in our system, and it speaks to the fact that Black people continue to be impacted adversely by racism that is embedded in every facet of our society. And so I think it's important for folks to recognize the ways in which our destinies are intertwined. And one, the anti-immigrant agenda moves on our communities and moves throughout our neighborhoods, our cities, our municipalities. We have to understand that it is actually endangering all of us and all people of color, period.
Opal Tometi there. She's the executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. This is Britain, not Africa. Those words were contained in a text message sent by an activist with the UK Independence Party, or UKIP, and published in a British newspaper over the weekend. The message was sent by the model Jo Marnie, along with a flurry of racist tweets about Prince Harry's fiancée, Meghan Markle. One of them read, "What's next, a Muslim prime minister? A black king?" The messages grabbed even more attention than they might have because Marnie is the now ex-girlfriend of Independence Party leader Henry Bolton, who is facing calls to step down. Eliza Anyangwe is a journalist in Britain who's worked for The Guardian and CNN. I asked her if she was surprised by Marnie's tweets.
Truthfully, no, I wasn't.
Why not?
Well, because I think that if you are a black or brown person in Britain, you know that racism is real. You feel it. It's not just in the comments people make. There are institutional barriers. But also in post-Brexit Britain, there have been far more visible acts of Islamophobia and xenophobia. So unfortunately, and particularly coming from someone affiliated with UKIP, these comments only just confirm what we know to be true among so many of the people we live with in this country.
I'm curious how Meghan Markle has been portrayed more generally in coverage of the royal wedding. I mean, has her race been a topic?
It has, right from the very beginning. And you find that, again, in the UK press, both on the left and on the right, that it... You know, the fact the color of her skin is part of the discussion. You know, so first of all, that Harry, the wild prince, is now settling down and is getting married, and then the fact that he has chosen for himself someone with mixed heritage is something that's very much a part of the discussion. There have also obviously been conversations about her being biracial or mixed race, and you know. To be fair, a lot of people are jubilant because they see this as an opening up even further of a very closed group, right? The royal, you know, you can't just sort of work your way to royalty. And those people who want to put a positive spin on it see this as the royal family becoming ever more accessible. And then there are those people who fear desperately for, as Jo Marnie said, how this will taint this very special group of people.
What's also striking is the mix of misogyny and racism revealed by these texts. Mm. Do those types of bigotry interact in a different way in the British context?
I think, you know, unlike America, we do not have a very open conversation here about race. A lot of the space where our prejudice played out was in third countries, right, in the colonies. So we've not had to live with the after effects of that in the way that Americans would be familiar and so therefore would have started a conversation about Jim Crow, civil rights, and now what is the legacy of that in modern America, the prison industrial complex, etc. Here, British people do not get taught about their history. We talk about empire as a positive thing. The whole framing around Brexit is that we have an opportunity for empire 2.0, stepping out on our own, and people feel very positive about that. And so when you then try and have a conversation around race and racism and institutional bias and institutional inequality, it's a very difficult conversation. Add to that, of course, that Brits are very polite. So you know, we don't tend to go straight to the point around these difficult conversations.
Eliza Anyangwe is a journalist based in Britain. Thanks for speaking with us, Eliza.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
You probably heard about that open letter published in the French newspaper Le Monde last week criticizing the Me Too movement. It said the movement amounted to puritanism and was fueled by a hatred of men. One of the most well-known signatories was the actress Catherine Deneuve. Well, the letter prompted a global backlash, and yesterday Deneuve apologized to victims of sexual assault. But she essentially doubled down on her argument. And it's gotten the world's Sarah Birnbaum thinking.
100 women signed on to this letter, but the one that jumped out at me and the one who made the headlines was Catherine Deneuve. When I saw she put her name to this thing, I thought, sure, typical. I mean, here's a woman who spent her entire career as a sex symbol. Of course she'd find a movement where women are saying, I'm not your sex object, incredibly threatening, because really few women have profited from male desire like Catherine Deneuve. So I went back to her movies so I can find even more to get angry about, because that's how I roll. And what I found there wasn't what I expected. Because in fact, if you look at her films, Deneuve and her milieu are not merely celebrating male desire or catering to it. They're actually grappling with it in an interesting way. I started with the 1965 film Repulsion. Deneuve plays Carole, a gorgeous beauty parlor assistant who's traumatized by the way men look at her and treat her. Carole reacts to this attention like a frightened animal. Her eyes are wide, her expression blank, her hair is wild. Eventually, she cracks and goes on a killing spree. In this scene, she slashes her landlord to death with a straight razor. Two years after Repulsion, Deneuve starred in her career-defining film, Belle de Jour. And her character, Séverine, isn't all that different from Carole. Séverine also hates the attention she gets from men, but instead of killing them, she turns the violence on herself. In this scene, she fantasizes about being tied to a tree while her husband and another man pelt her with mud and scream obscenities at her.
Comment ça va, petite ordure?
Alors, tu vas bien, espèce de traînée?
Eventually, the self-loathing drives Séverine to prostitution. So now let's get back to the Me Too letter. It says women don't have to be reduced to, quote, defenseless prey, like Carole, and they don't have to be forever traumatized, like Séverine. And the message that Deneuve's success embodies is that you can use your sex appeal as a weapon or a tool. And that does seem feminist. It's just dated.
So it feels to me as though Catherine Deneuve is stuck in the 60s.
That's Nancy Bauer, a feminist philosopher at Tufts University in Boston.
It's hard to be a woman aging, and one wonders whether part of what Catherine Deneuve, who still looks like a somewhat older version of herself in the 60s, feels as though she still has to project this robustly what she perceives as pro-sex position.
Deneuve has since clarified her position and has written another letter to another French newspaper where she apologizes to all the victims who may have felt offended by the first letter. But she also reiterated that the current atmosphere threatens sexual freedom. The thing that makes both these letters so troubling is they ignore the real harm being done to women. Bauer agrees.
They make a number of actually philosophically faulty arguments, and arguments that just seem absurd to women who've suffered as a result of sexual harassment on the job or sexual assault in any context.
And while repressive sexual mores probably didn't do women a ton of good either, that's just not where the fight is today. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Just ahead, the Haitian American using art to silence Donald Trump. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. If you've been on social media on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, you may well have caught a glimpse of a particular image that's getting a lot of shares.
Basically, the picture is an image of Martin Luther King. He's extending his hand out to kind of cover the mouth of our current president while he's tweeting away and just wishing and hoping that he would think with a more equality type of mind rather than, you know, some of the negative stuff that he has been putting out into the universe.
Martin Luther King Jr. trying to hush a tweeting Donald Trump. The picture is called My Brother's Keeper, and it was created by Haitian American artist Watson Meir.
Martin Luther King Day was coming up last year, and I wanted to create an image in honor of Martin Luther King. However, a week before Martin Luther King Day, it was actually the inauguration. And, you know, with the atmosphere in the air and everything that was going on in the news, my spirit just led me to add Trump to the image as well.
You were born in South Florida, but your parents are immigrants. Tell us about them, where they came from and why.
Parents are originally from Haiti, currently right now U.S. citizens, but originally from Haiti. Came here to find a better life. Around the time that they did leave Haiti, it was in some turmoil and, you know, the poverty that's going on in Haiti. They knew their children would have better opportunities in America as well.
I know your path to art was an unusual one. Tell us about it.
Actually, wasn't able to speak until the age of four, but I went to a special preschool around the age of three, and the teachers there, because I wasn't able to speak, in order to help me communicate, actually taught me how to draw. And that actually is something I've carried on my whole life. Whatever vision I have in my head, I've been able to kind of transfer it in through my art.
And at this point, you are a working artist, aren't you?
Yes, yes, I am.
But I read that you majored in business.
Yes. Yep, I surely did, yep.
Was that in order to make sure you could actually make a living from art?
Yeah, basically it was something, especially with Haitian parents, they always want you. Education is definitely one of the main things that they look for in their children. But I knew in my heart that I always wanted to go back into the art because it was just something that just resonated with me so much.
I have to ask, there's lots of stereotypes about immigrant parents wanting their kids to be doctors or engineers. How did your parents feel about you becoming an artist?
I'll be honest, that is a stereotype that has some validity to it. But my parents, they actually didn't have an issue with it. They seem to be like, you know, whatever makes you happy, like they'll support it.
How do you make your pictures?
I actually utilize a very weird technique that most people don't use. I actually utilize Microsoft Paint with a mouse. Just a screen and a mouse, and I just get to work. I've actually been using that technique since I was probably in the middle school. My parents purchased a computer, and I've been practicing with it ever since, and I've gotten to do it so much that I'm actually able to draw with a mouse better than I am with a pencil or a paintbrush.
Hmm. Now, as you know, last week, President Trump reportedly said, "Why do we need more Haitians?" And he suggested that people from Haiti should not be included in a visa program that was being proposed. How did you respond when you heard that?
Honestly, it was something that, you know, really disheartening. I try not to lay down much that he says get to me, but that one there really hit a special place, not only for me, but for millions of Haitians all across the world, because that was also during the time of the earthquake. The anniversary of the earthquake was literally around that exact same time. And, you know, usually ever since the earthquake, that's been a day where Haitians, you know, we kind of reflect and the loved ones that we did lose and, you know, people that we don't even know. Is just Haitians are some of the most connected people. Like if I were to go into any city in the United States or around the world, if I see someone with a Haitian flag, like we're automatically brothers, not even friends. We're automatically brothers or sisters. So on that day, we usually that's a day of grieving for us. And for those comments to come around the same time, it was really hard. Like right now to this day, it's still kind of hard to talk about. But that included with the comments, it really struck hard, to be honest with you.
Haitian-American artist Watson Meir. Thanks, Watson.
Thank you so much.
Pope Francis is visiting Chile and Peru this week. It'll be something of a homecoming for him. The Pope is from Argentina, right next door to Chile. But the visit might not be a complete love fest. It's Francis's first trip to Chile as Pope, and it comes at a time of big challenges for the Catholic Church there. Around 60% of Chileans identify as Catholic, but the country's confidence in the Church is waning. Here's reporter Emily Green in Santiago.
Maria Eugenia Alabaco went to church every Sunday as a kid. She was so devout, she thought about becoming a nun.
Creo que no habría sido una buena monja.
I think I wouldn't have become a good nun, she laughs. She remembers the day she began to question the church. Her grandfather had died, and she brought the casket to the local church. The priest was in the middle of a funeral ceremony.
Y paró eso para preguntar.
The priest stopped the ceremony to ask if Ilabaca and her family had paid money so her grandfather could be brought there. They hadn't. They didn't know they needed to. The priest forced them to take her grandfather's casket away. But the final straw came decades later, when it was revealed that hundreds, possibly thousands of kids were sexually abused by Chilean priests.
En vez de sacarlos de la iglesia o excomulgarlos o qué sé yo,
instead of kicking the priests out of the church or excommunicating them, they're sent to places far away where they continue their lives like normal, Ilabaca says. She's not alone in her disillusionment. Over the past two decades, public confidence here in the Catholic Church has plummeted, and fewer Chileans identify as Catholic. At the same time, evangelical Christianity has taken off, attracting former Catholics like 28-year-old Andrea Latorre. I met her in the train station in Santiago.
Yo pienso que la religión católica es mucho dinero.
Latorre says the Catholic religion has a lot of money, and so does the Vatican. So she's not interested in the Pope's visit. That's a big change from 1987, when Pope John Paul II visited Chile during the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. He called for the country to move toward democracy.
La iglesia cuando terminó la dictadura era la...
Fernando Montes is a priest here, and he says when the dictatorship ended in 1990, the church was the most respected institution in Chile, but not anymore. And Pope Francis hasn't helped matters, Montes says. He appointed a bishop who's accused of covering up sexual abuse cases, prompting protests.
Si no vio lo que el otro sacerdote hacía,
he says if the bishop didn't know about the sex abuse, that just shows he's not paying attention and shouldn't be the bishop. But if he did know about the abuse but didn't say anything, that's even worse. Other Chileans say the church has become too focused on people's personal sexual lives. Most recently, it lobbied heavily against a new law that legalized abortion in narrow circumstances, including rape. Senator Ignacio Walker supported the legislation.
I've got the impression that the church, which is my church, I'm a Catholic, replaced social morality for sexual morality.
Still, there's no denying that a lot of Chileans are thrilled to see the Pope during his three-day visit here. But his presence may come too late to shore up support for an ailing institution. For The World, Emily Green, Santiago, Chile.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. What will your story be in 2018? Now that the holiday rush is over, LegalZoom can help you make this a memorable year before all the distractions take hold. Make this the year you finally get serious about launching and running your business. Rest a little easier knowing your family's future is squared away with the right estate plan. LegalZoom has been helping people like you take care of their dreams and responsibilities for more than 16 years. They're not a law firm, but they have the resources to keep you on the right path, including advice from their network of independent attorneys, all at your fingertips. Whether you want to take your business to the next level or take control of your family's future with an estate plan, LegalZoom plugs right into your life so you can take care of the things that matter most and get off to a strong start in 2018. More information available at LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com/world.
I'm Carol Hills. Teaching accented English isn't easy.
If I speak with Russian accent, I have to move the energy into the throat area a little bit more. If I'm speaking in a more like English accent, I have to move it all forward and make it more narrow like that.
Finding and losing your accent. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. We hear a lot of accents on this program, voices from outside the country, from immigrants, even regional accents from different parts of the U.S. But there are also a lot of people here in the U.S. who used to have accents but don't anymore. So for the next few minutes, we're going to consider accents and the lengths that people go to lose them. Exhibit A, the Boston accent, considered by some as America's, well, most distinctive. So of course, that's highly subjective. Here's a taste.
The first one you probably want to try to master is, hi, how are ya?
Two blondes were in a parking lot, trying to unlock the door of their car.
Benga Yui, get on the rotary, take Route 3 to Route 95, get on the pike and you're there.
This is the accent Louis Cronin tried to lose. She's one of our sound engineers here at The World. Louis, did you sound like that growing up?
Yes, I did.
Did you say Kana instead of corner?
I said, meet me on the Kana.
So when did you decide you wanted to lose your accent?
In high school. I think I was a sophomore in high school, and I was singing in the chorus. And I heard my whole high school choir singing with the Boston accent. And I thought, this sounds ridiculous. And I think the song we were singing was, remember that song, Try to Remember the...
Time of September?
Yes.
Try to remember...
But it was Try to Remember the Time of September. And I heard it and I said, oh my God, that sounds dumb. I don't want to sound like that. So I went home and I used to stand in front of the mirror and practice and say 44 and hour corner. And I practiced and, you know, my mother said, you sound like a snot. And when I went to school, everybody started making fun of me.
Yeah. But you stuck to it.
I stuck to it. Yeah, I wanted to get rid of it.
There are, of course, many reasons why we change our accents, and sometimes why we don't. One place you'll find a lot of accents and some people trying to change theirs is New York. For a few, the few who can afford it, there's an option of working with a coach in the accent modification business. For that story, we're going to turn now to reporter Alina Simone.
On the fourth floor of an unassuming office building a couple of blocks from Trump Tower, immigrant clients of Accents Off are preparing for battle, running through their survival words. Only survival in this case depends on nailing the pronunciation of words like miserable, vegetable, and wholesale.
You have to use them. So you need them to survive, but you can't, and so you drown.
Ilya Nasanov was born in Estonia, grew up speaking Russian, and came to New York to work at an Australian bank. When he arrived, he sounded like this.
Please call Stella. Ask her to bring these things with her from the store.
At his old job at the Russian branch of the bank, his English wasn't an issue. Everyone sounded like him.
There I was sort of local, so it was a bit easier. I could get away with it. But here I'm clearly foreign. So, and that was a foreign accent, and I had to fix something. That extra second that it takes, that it took them to, and still takes probably, to translate my English into their English.
For some immigrants, accent modification is just a matter of self-improvement. But for many, it's a means of getting a job or keeping one, making sure you're competitive, shaving off that extra second. Many immigrants may want help with their accents, but accent coaching isn't cheap. So there are not a lot of cab drivers here at the company founded by Rochelle D'Olivera.
Kill the accent! I heard that once.
Rochelle projects the confidence of a news anchor and the poise of a pianist, which she actually was before becoming a speech pathologist and founding Accents Off. When she started out 6 years ago, her clients were mostly actors. Today, the majority are professionals, filling Midtown offices just like this one.
I have had people come in here tearful and concerned that they may be losing their job if they don't work on their speech. Some of them, however, are concerned that their accent is holding them back. They're concerned about the impression that they're making in the company. They just want to make sure that they have everything working in their favor.
This free-floating anxiety is backed by a growing body of scientific research that shows, yeah, employers really do discriminate against accented Americans.
Even for positions which didn't require face-to-face or linguistic contact, people said, no, I'm much less likely to hire this person because of their speech.
Dennis Preston is a professor of linguistics at the University of Oklahoma, a pioneer in the field of perceptual dialectology, the study of how people react to variations in language. Accent bias goes deep enough to affect how well we understand people of different ethnic and linguistic backgrounds, even when their English is perfect. One study, Preston explains, involved playing a recording of someone speaking English, but identifying the speaker as either white or Asian. People were asked to react.
And when they were looking at an Asian face, they actually understood it less well.
Yeah, the very same speaker with a different face. The impact our eyes have on what we're hearing?
It very seldom has anything really to do with language, that it has to do with a transfer of stereotypes about people to language.
Discriminating against people because of their ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender have become widespread social taboos. But discriminating against how people talk?
You're not supposed to make fun of people with Asian faces, but it's okay to criticize accents.
And it's not just people with foreign accents. It's Americans with regional accents, especially from the South. Call it language profiling. And that's where going to a class to lose your accent gets controversial.
For us, it means that it's one of the symbols that people are used to treating other people who are not very much like them badly. And in this case, of course, they have the support of some people who point to dictionaries. These are people who usually don't see what's actually in dictionaries, but point to them, or to English teachers or to grammar books, but unknowingly, because they don't know what English teachers really know and believe, and they've probably never really seen a grammar book. But they take a great deal of comfort in the idea that somewhere out there, there's an English which is completely unmarked. This, of course, is like a unicorn or a tooth fairy or anything else. Every time you open your mouth, you mark yourself as being a member of something.
In 2014, managers at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, a federal science and technology lab in East Tennessee, decided to offer a, quote, Southern accent reduction class. Here's the email that was sent to thousands of employees. Feel confident in a meeting when you need to speak with a more neutral American accent, and be remembered for what you say, and not how you say it.
If I had received that letter, I would have probably been very upset with that letter.
This is Todd Matthews, a friend of mine who lives in Tennessee, about an hour and a half from Oak Ridge.
What if I'd sent somebody in New York or Michigan a note saying, I'm going to help you get rid of your northern accent? You know, can you imagine the flip that that would be if somebody told you, Elaine, I need to help you get rid of your speaking problem. And you didn't realize you had a speaking problem.
Todd actually works for a different federal program where he serves as director of communications. Yes, communications. He's definitely familiar with the kind of accent bias linguist Dennis Preston discussed.
Before somebody puts me in an uncomfortable spot and then we have this a little bit of tension with somebody looking at you like, I don't understand what you're saying. You know, I will say I am the director of case management communications and I am from Tennessee, and they knew that when they hired me. So I'll try to, you know, if I'm speaking to somebody, so we'll all have a life, and then that kind of breaks the tension where you're not getting people looking sideways at you. So I know everything's going through their mind. Why is that person in that chair?
So what about the Tennessee residents invited to participate in the Southern accent reduction class? The implication that their accent, ergo their identity, was something to be reduced, neutralized, or forgotten did not go over well. The lab ended up canceling the class and publicly apologizing. Okay, back to the non-Americans studying with Rochelle de Oliveira in New York. Sounding a bit more American, however you define that, is a desirable thing for these students. It's also among the most difficult, and regardless of how hard you work, success depends on factors that aren't all under your control, like which language you grew up speaking, and your age.
By the time people get into their teens, it becomes more tricky, and it's more of an uphill battle for sure. When you get into your late teens, early 20s, it can still be done.
But it takes longer, Rochelle says. Your oral apparatus, lips, tongue, jaw, throat, function like a machine, precision tooled to produce the sounds of your native tongue. To learn a different accent, you have to understand how that machine works, take it apart, and reassemble it. Rochelle's an expert in all that.
If I speak with Russian accent, I have to move the throat. I have to move the energy into the throat area a little bit more, like this. If I'm speaking in a more like English accent, I have to move it all forward and make it more narrow like that. But if I want to go back to American, then I have to find that very nice big open space in the middle of the mouth and let the sounds roll around in there.
Aside from mouth mechanics, students also struggle with something called sound confusion, the inability to distinguish sounds, some of which may not even exist in their language, like th. And that's an easy one. Say you're an American trying to learn Thai.
Thai is a tonal language. So you have, for example, ga 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 ga. These are all five different words. ga, 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 right?
This is Lisa Trompagob, an engineer at Google and another former student at Accents Off. Speakers of Asian languages, Rochelle says, face a much more difficult task in emulating a standard American accent.
The tongue is very low in the mouth for Asian accents. And for example, they have trouble with L, final L at the end of a word. For example, people. You'll hear a Chinese person, instead of saying people, they'll say people. And getting that tongue into position up behind the upper front teeth on the palate, very, very difficult for them. The tongue is not used to having to rise up and perform these movements that American English requires.
Like, just keep doing that for a while. To like, stretching your tongue, right? Like, to move your tongue back and forth for, like, for R and L, yeah.
Most of the professionals who come to Accents Off aren't trying to erase their identities or morph into Terry Gross. They just want to remove the friction from everyday conversation, make their lives and, yeah, their jobs easier. Before we say goodbye, I ask Ilya, the student from Estonia, what his survival words are. You know, the words that you really need to say correctly to survive the English-speaking world. He's a banker, so I was expecting words like liquidity and amortize. But instead,
there are some funky long words like synchronized and thunderstorm and characteristics. And like, I just couldn't tell, say them.
They were, too, were these your survival words?
They were my survival.
Thunderstorm?
Thunderstorm, yeah.
The notorious TH. I grew up making fun of my Russian father for saying thank you instead of thank you. Sorry, Dad. Well, next time there's a big thunderstorm here in New York, I think Ilya's going to make himself understood.
Alina Simone reporting. So, Louis Cronin is still with us. Louis, you've written a novel which is set in your hometown, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and you write very amusingly about the divide between the townies and the Harvard types. Did that spill over into Accents, too?
Oh, yes. In fact, I had a part in the novel where I described the cousin of the main character, and she works in City Hall, where I say it's important that she keep her accent to keep her job. So I think that, you know, people will slip in and out of the accent. Like, honestly, like if I'm calling the Department of Public Works and asking them if they'll pick up a couch, I'll slip right into the accent. Or if I'm just in an environment and everybody has one, it's almost like a comfortable, easy place to go into.
Were there particular words or sounds that were especially hard?
Oh, yeah. Like, I think the hardest word is parka.
As in ski jacket.
As in ski jacket, because you want to drop the R in park, but then you want to put it in at the end. So, you know, you'll often hear a person with a Boston accent say Parker.
Parker.
Parker, yeah. That's a hard one. Or khaki.
Khaki, like khaki pants?
Like khaki pants, yeah. So that's a hard one.
So how would the old Louis say it?
Khaki.
And how does the new Louis say it?
I avoid it.
You can't just say khaki.
Khaki. But it's one of those. The other one that's hard is like pizza.
Really?
Yeah, because if you start throwing these R's in, and in my head, I have to throw an R in, so it's pizza. So,
do you ever regret losing your accent?
No.
You don't think, like, you lost a piece of yourself along the way?
No, I really don't. I really don't. I never regret losing it.
Louis Cronin is a sound engineer here at WGBH in Boston and author of the novel Everyone Loves You Back. You can hear from Louis on our language podcast, The World in Words. Check it out wherever you listen to podcasts or at pri.org/language. What would you do if you thought you had 15 minutes to find shelter from an incoming nuclear missile? That's the reality people in Hawaii thought they were facing Saturday morning when they received an emergency warning just after 8 a.m. local time. Residents and tourists saw this message flash on their cell phones. Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. It wasn't until more than a half an hour later that they received another message saying that it had been a false alarm. It was a mistake caused by an employee of Hawaii's Emergency Management Agency during an internal drill. The employee has been reassigned, and the agency says it won't conduct any more drills until new procedures are in place so that it won't happen again. Still, the false alarm caused panic in a state that's already on alert from threats made by North Korea. David Harada Stone lives on Hawaii's Big Island. David, what a scare Saturday morning. Where were you?
Well, actually, I was up and actually had my phone in my hand at the time. We were looking at movie times. We were planning to go see a show later in the day. I felt the buzz in my hand first. And you know, we've gotten these alerts in the past. Our island's no stranger to natural disasters. And usually they involve flash flooding or active volcanoes or something. But when I read the text of this, I have to admit I was more confused and befuddled than I was terrified initially. I thought this couldn't possibly be right. We turned on the TV and there was an emergency broadcast system alert on that too, and it told us to stay away from windows. So basically we huddled in a windowless hallway for about 15 or 20 minutes until we confirmed online that it was a false alarm.
What do you remember thinking or feeling while you're huddled in the hallway?
90% of my mind was telling me this can't be right and it has to be a mistake and someone had to screw up. But, you know, there was the 9-10%. Oh, anything's possible, especially with two seemingly unstable guys constantly exchanging schoolyard taunts over Twitter. So, yeah, I still had my phone and my daughter had hers. And, you know, we were checking online. We figured if it is a false alarm, shouldn't they have told us by now? So we just sort of hunkered down and waited. My concern was, you know, to the extent I thought about it at all, it was about what do we do if this is real? I mean, how does this island survive?
Did you grab anything precious?
Just the dachshund.
You mentioned that in Hawaii, you're kind of used to getting alerts that usually about natural disasters. But what has Hawaii done to respond to the more recent threats from North Korea? I mean, where somebody could actually take shelter from a nuclear attack.
I don't think Hawaii's, I mean, substantively done a whole lot. I grew up in the 60s, and early on, we had those duck and cover drills like the rest of the country. And we knew, given the extended military installations on Oahu, where I grew up, that it was always a possibility. But in terms of on a daily basis, I don't think people think about it that much, except, you know, again, when Trump and Kim Jong-un engage in Twitter wars, that sort of reminds us of our proximity to the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, you're less than 5,000 miles away.
Yeah, it doesn't leave much time for action on our part.
Have you been comparing notes with friends or family about how they responded to the false alarm?
Yeah, I think most have some similar tales. I read of a friend whose mom just decided to go back to bed and figure out whether she's going to wake up in the morning or not, or she'll know then. You know, others like me decided that after it was over to go get a stiff drink. So I had my first Bloody Mary in the morning for a while. I usually make it a point not to drink before 5 p.m., but I made an exception that day.
David Harada Stone lives on Hawaii's Big Island. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Lacey Healy. She's a nuclear policy analyst in Washington, D.C., and also the host of the new PRI podcast called Things That Go Boom. First off, Lacey, I understand your parents live in Hawaii. Were you in touch with them as this false alarm unfolded?
It's funny. I'm going to be there next week. And so I was running around actually doing a bunch of errands. And I just happened to open Facebook. And why my mother, this was the first place she went. But my mom had posted the alert on Facebook. And my first thought was, oh, my God, North Korea is conducting that test in the Pacific. And it's funny to me now that, you know, as a nuclear policy analyst, that was my first reaction because I didn't go immediately to North Korea's nuking Hawaii. I thought they're conducting that test in the Pacific that they've been threatening. That's what they do. They do things that they threaten to do. And oh my God, the fallout. My parents are going to be exposed to the fallout. So I immediately called my mom.
So what did they say to you?
So then they had just found out that all was safe, but my mom, she said she was shaking. She had just realized that it was actually scary. She was almost in a state of denial while it was happening. But then afterward, it really hit her that this could really happen. And she's been shaking since. The gravity of it really hit afterward.
There have been concerns that mistakes like the one that happened in Hawaii could actually lead to nuclear war. Can you walk us through that scenario? How could that happen?
Mistakes like the one in Hawaii, imagine, so all of these people who have no ability to respond, they received an alert on their cell phone. That alert is very similar to the kind of alert that President Trump might receive. And in that moment, President Trump is the one person who will have to make the decision whether or not to respond. And this depends on your opinion of President Trump, but he might be the kind of person who would make that decision very quickly. And so if he makes that decision, we've launched a nuclear weapon at North Korea, and then we're in a nuclear war.
I thought there was another layer that the president can say, okay, but that the military would have to carry out the actual launch.
This is true. The military would have to carry out the actual launch, but I fail to be convinced by arguments that the military would defy the commander-in-chief. This is just not how our country is set up. If the commander-in-chief, our president, issued an order to launch a nuclear weapon, the military commander who defied that order would be someone really special. And that's not necessarily a compliment. I have a very hard time thinking of the kind of military commander who might say no.
Lacey, my final question is, what can we do to avoid these false alarms, which seem to me to be quite dangerous in and of themselves?
Yeah. The fact is we can't. We can do quite a lot to correct problems. We can make sure that things like not being able to rescind an emergency warning are corrected. But that's not really the point here. Human error is always a part of the calculation, and it will always be a part of the calculation as long as humans are involved. And I think that we all want humans to continue to be involved. So we have to understand that when we are dealing with nuclear weapons, the first line of defense is not this type of thing. It's not reacting to a nuclear weapon that's been launched at us. It is reacting now to the state that we're in and taking all measures to make sure that the current state is de-escalated. We have to talk to North Korea, and we have to let deterrence do its job. We have to let diplomacy do its job, and we have to de-escalate the situation.
Lacey Healy is the host of the new PRI podcast, Things That Go Boom. Thanks, Lacey.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Keep calm and carry on.
PRI, Public Radio International.